The female led the way, no weapons to be seen, her gait unhurried. But when they halted in the shadows beneath the awning, the female held up a hand once more. Golden flame danced between her fingers. Elide recoiled, and the fire vanished as quickly as it had appeared. "My name is Essar," the female said softly. "I am a friend, of your friends, I believe." Elide said nothing. "Cairn is a monster," Essar said, taking a step closer. "Stay far from him. I need to find him. You played the part of his mistreated lover well enough. You have to know something about him, what he does. If you know where he is, please tell me." She wasn't above begging. Essar ran an eye over Elide. Then she said, "He was in this city until yesterday. Then he went out to the eastern camp." She pointed with a thumb over a shoulder. "He's there now."
"How do you know?"
"Because he's not terrorizing the patrons of every fine establishment in this town, glutting himself on the coin Maeve gave him when he took the blood oath." Elide blinked. She had hoped some of the Fae might be opposed to Maeve, especially after the battle in Eelway. But to find such outright distaste? Essar then added,
"And because my sister, the soldier you spoke with, told me. She saw him in the camp this morning, smirking like a cat."
"Why should I believe you?"
"Because you are wearing Lorcan's shirt
and Rowan Whitethorn's cloak. If you do not believe me, inform them who told you, and they will."
Elide cocked her head to the side. Essar said softly,
"Lorcan and I were involved for a time."
They were in the midst of war, and had traveled for thousands of miles to find their queen. And yet the tightness that coiled in Elide's gut at those words somehow found space. Lorcan's lover. This delicate beauty with a bedroom voice had been Lorcan's lover.
"I'll be missed if I'm gone for too long. But tell them who I am. Tell them that I told you. If it's Cairn they seek, that is where he shall be. His precise location I don't know."
Essar backed away a step.
"Don't go asking after Cairn at the other taverns. He isn't well regarded, even amongst the soldiers. And those who do follow him, you do not wish to attract their interest."
Essar made to turn away, but Elide blurted, "Where did Maeve go?" Essar looked over her shoulder, studied her. The female's eyes widened.
"She has Aelin of the Wildfire,"
Essar breathed. Elide said nothing, but Essar murmured,
That was the power we felt the other night."
Essar swept back toward Elide, gripped her hands.
"Where Maeve went a few days ago, I don't know. She did not announce it, did not take anyone with her. I often serve her, am asked to. It doesn't matter. What matters is Maeve is not here. But I do not know when she will return."
Relief again threatened to send Elide crumpling to the ground. The gods, it seemed, had not abandoned them just yet. But if Maeve had taken Aelin to the outpost where they'd lied that the Vog Prince had been contained? Elide gripped Essar's hands, finding them warm and dry.
"Does your sister know where Cairn resides in the camp?" For long minutes, then an hour, they had talked.
Essar left and returned with Drizenda, her sister. And in that alley, they had plotted. Elide finished telling Rowan, Lorcan, and Gavriel what she'd learned. They sat in stunned silence for a long minute.
"Just before dawn," Elide repeated. "Drizenda said the watch on the eastern camp is weakest at dawn, that she'd find a way for the guards to be occupied. It's our only window."
Rowan was staring into the trees, as if he could see the layout of the camp, as if he were plotting his way in, Way out?
She didn't confirm if Aelin was in Cairn's tent, though,
Gabriel cautioned.
Maeve is gone. Aelin might be with her, too.
It's a risk we take,
Rowan said. A risk perhaps they should have considered. Elide glanced to Lorcan, who had been silent throughout. Even though it had been his lover who had helped them, perhaps guided by Aneth herself, or at least had been tipped off by the scent on Elide's clothes.
You think we can trust her?
Elide asked Lorcan, though she knew the answer. Lorcan's dark eyes shifted to her.
Yes, though I don't see why she'd bother. She's a good female, that's why,
Rowan said. At Elide's lifted brow, he explained.
Essar visited Mistward this spring. She met Aelin.
He cut a glare toward Lorcan.
And asked me to tell you that she sends her best.
Elide hadn't seen anything that came close to pining in Essar's face. But gods, she was beautiful. And smart, and kind. And Lorcan had let her go somehow. Gabriel cut in.
If we move on the eastern camp, we need to figure out our plan now. Get into position. It's miles away.
Rowan gazed again toward that distant camp.
If you're debating flying there right now,
Lorcan growled,
then you'll deserve whatever misery comes of your stupidity.
Rowan flashed his teeth, but Lorcan said,
We all go in. We all go out.
Elide nodded, in agreement for once. Lorcan seemed to stiffen in surprise. Rowan arrived at that conclusion, too, because he crouched and plunged a knife into the mossy earth.
This is Cairn's tent,
he said of the dagger, and fished for a nearby pine cone.
This is the southern entrance to the camp.
And so they planned. Rowan had parted from his companions an hour ago, sending them to take up their positions. They would not all go in, all go out. Rowan would break into the eastern camp, taking the southernmost entrance. Gabriel and Lorcan would be waiting for his signal near the east entrance, hidden in the forest just beyond the rolling, grassy hills on that side of the camp. Ready to unleash hell when he sent a flare of his magic, diverting soldiers to their side while Rowan made his run for Aelin. Elide would wait for them farther in that forest, or flee, if things went badly. She'd protested, but even Gabriel had told her that she was mortal, untrained. And what she'd done today? Rowan didn't have the words to convey his gratitude for what Elide had done, the unexpected ally she'd found. He trusted Essar. She'd never liked Maeve, had outright said she did not serve her with any willingness or pride. But these last few hours before dawn, when so many things could go wrong? Maeve was not here. That much, at least, had gone right. Rowan lingered in the steep hills above the southern entrance to the camp. He'd easily kept hidden from the sentries in the trees, his wind masking any trace of his scent. Down below, spread across the grassy eastern plain, the army camp glittered. She had to be there. Aelin had to be there. If they had come so close but wound up being the very thing that had caused Maeve to take Aelin away again, to bring her along to the outpost. Rowan pushed against the weight in his chest. The bond within him lay dark and slumbering. No indication of her proximity. Essar had no idea that Aelin was being kept here until Elide informed her. How many others hadn't known? How well had Maeve hidden her? If Aelin wasn't in that camp tomorrow, they'd find Cairn, at least. And get some answers then. Give him a taste of what he'd done. Rowan shut out the thought. He didn't let himself think of what had been done to her. He'd do that tomorrow, when he saw Cairn. When he repaid him for every moment of pain. Overhead, the stars shone clear and bright. And though Mala had only once appeared to him at dawn, on the foothills across this very city, though she might be little more than a strange, mighty being from another world, he offered up a prayer anyway. Then, He had begged Mala to protect Aelin from Maeve when they entered Doranel, to give her strength and guidance, and to let her walk out alive. Then, he had begged Mala to let him remain with Aelin, the woman he loved. The goddess had been little more than a sunbeam in the rising dawn, and yet he had felt her smile at him. Tonight, with only the cold fire of the stars for company, he begged her once more. A curl of wind sent his prayer drifting to those stars, to the waxing moon silvering the camp, the river, the mountains. He had killed his way across the world. He had gone to war and back more times than he cared to remember. And despite it all, despite the rage and despair and ice he'd wrapped around his heart, he'd still found Aelin. Every horizon he'd gazed toward, unable and unwilling to rest during those centuries. Every mountain and ocean he'd seen and wondered what lay beyond. It had been her. It had been Aelin, the silent call of the mating bond driving him, even when he could not feel it. They'd walked this dark path together back to the light. He would not let the road end here. Chapter 24. The Crokins ignored her, and ignored the 13. A few hissed insults as they passed, but one glance from Manon, and the 13 kept their fists balled at their sides. The Crokins remained in the camp for a week to tend to their wounded, so Manon and the 13 had remained as well, ignored and hated. "What is this place?" Manon asked Glennis, as she found the crone polishing the handle of a gold-bound broom beside the fire. Two others lay on a cloak nearby. Menial work for the witch in charge of this camp.
"This is an ancient camp, one of the oldest, we claim."
Glennis's knobbed fingers flew over the broom handle.
"Each of the 7 great hearths has a fire here, as do many others."
Indeed, there were far more than 7 in the camp.
"It was a gathering place for us after the war. And since then it had become a place to usher in some of our younger witches to adulthood. It is a rite we've developed over the years. To send them into the deep wilds for a few weeks to hunt and survive with only their brooms and a knife. We remain here while they do so."
Manon asked quietly, "Do you know what our initiation rite is?" Glennis's face tightened.
"I do. We all do."
Which hearth had the witch she'd killed at age 16 belonged to? What had her grandmother done with the Crokin heart she'd brought back in a box to Blackbeak Keep, wearing her enemy's cloak as a trophy? But Manon asked, "When do you head to Eelway?"
"Tomorrow. Those who were the most gravely wounded in the skirmish have healed enough to travel, or survive here on their own."
Manon's gut tightened, but she shut out the regret. Glennis extended one of the brooms to Manon, its base bound with ordinary metal threads.
"Do you fly south with us?"
Manon took the broom, the wood zinging against her hand. The wind whispered at her ear of the fast, wicked current between the peaks above. She and the 13 had already decided days ago. If south was where the Crokins went, then south was where they would go, even if each passing day might spell doom for those in the north.
"We fly with you," Manon said.
Glennis nodded.
"That broom belongs to a black-haired witch named Carson."
The crone jerked her chin toward the tents behind Manon.
"She's on duty by your wyverns."
Dorian decided he didn't need a hidden place to practice, which was lucky, since there was no such thing as privacy in the Crokin's camp. Not inside the camp, and certainly not around it. Not with the sharp eyes of their sentinels patrolling day and night. Which is how he wound up sitting before Vesta at Glennis's hearth, the red-haired witch half asleep with boredom. "Learning, shifting," she groused, yawning for the 10th time that hour.
"Seems like a colossal waste of time."
She flicked a snow-white hand toward the makeshift training ring, where the 13 kept up their honed bodies and instincts.
You could be sparring with Lin right now.
I just watched Lin nearly knock Imogen's teeth down her throat. Forgive me if I'm in no mood to get into the ring with her.
Vesta arched an auburn brow.
No male swaggering from you, then.
I like my teeth where they are. He sighed. I'm trying to concentrate.
None of the witches, even Manon, had questioned why he practiced. He'd only mentioned nearly a week ago that the spider had made him wonder if he might be able to shift, using his raw magic, and they'd shrugged.
Their focus was on the Krokins, on the trip to Eelway that would likely happen any day now. He hadn't heard any mention of a warband gathering, but if it could divide Morath's forces even slightly, to venture south to deal with them. If it distracted Erewhon when Dorian went to the Volg King's stronghold, he'd accept it. He'd already offered Manon and Glenys what he knew regarding the kingdom and its rulers. Nehemia's parents and two younger brothers. Otterlin's empire had done its work thoroughly in decimating Eelway's army, so any hope on that front was impossible. But if they mustered a few thousand soldiers to head northward, it'd be a boon for his friends. If they could survive, it would be enough. Dorian closed his eyes, and Vesta fell silent. For days, she'd sat with him when her training and scouting permitted it, watching for any of the shifting that he attempted, changing his hair, his skin, his eyes. None of it occurred. His magic had touched that stolen shifter's power, had learned it just enough before he'd killed the spider. It was now a matter of convincing his magic to become like that shifter's power. Whether it had ever been done with raw magic before, he did not know.
Be what you wish,
Cyrene had told him. Nothing. He wished to be nothing. But Dorian kept peering inward, into every hollow, every empty corner. He need only do it long enough to master the shifting, to sneak into Morath and find the third key, to then offer up all he was and had been to the lock and the gate. And then it would be over. For Erewhon, yes. And for him. Even if it would leave Hollin with the right to the throne. Hollin, who had been sired by a Volg-infested man as well. Had the demon passed any traits to his brother? The boy had been beastly. But had he been human? Hollin had not killed their father, shattered the castle, let Sorsha die. Dorian hadn't dared ask Damaris, wasn't certain what he'd do should the sword reveal what he was deep down. So Dorian peered inward, where his magic flowed in him, to where it could move between flame and water and ice and wind. But no matter how he willed it, how he pictured brown hair or paler skin or freckles, nothing happened. She was no messenger, but Manon took the hint, and the offer, along with three other brooms, all for witches across the camp. It would not be enough to fly with them to Eelway. No, she'd have to learn about them, each of these witches. Asterin, who'd been monitoring from across the fire, fell into step beside her, taking up two of the brooms.
I forgot they used the redwood, her second said, studying the brooms in her arms. A hell of a lot easier to carve than the ironwood.
Manon could still feel how her own hands had ached during the long days she'd whittled down her first broom from the log of ironwood she'd found deep in Oakwald. The first two ventures had resulted in snapped shafts, and she'd resolved to carve her broom more carefully. Three tries, one for each face of the goddess. She'd been 13. Mere weeks past her first bleeding, which had brought about the zipping current of power that called to the wind, that flowed through the brooms and carried them into the skies. Each stroke of the chisel, each pound of the hammer that transformed the block of near impenetrable material, had transferred that power into the emerging broom itself. Where'd you leave yours? Manon asked. Asterin shrugged.
Somewhere at Blackbeak Keep.
Manon nodded.
Hers was currently discarded in the back of a closet in her room at her grandmother's seat of power. She'd thrown it in there after magic had vanished. The broom little more than a cleaning tool without it.
I suppose we won't be retrieving them now, Asterin said.
No, we won't,
Manon said, scanning the skies.
We fly with the Krakens to Ilwe tomorrow, to rendezvous with whatever human warband they're to meet.
Asterin's mouth tightened. Perhaps we'll convince all of them, the Krakens, the Ilwe warband, to head north.
Perhaps, if they were lucky enough. If they did not squander so much time that Erewhon crushed the north into dust. They reached the first of the witches Glennis had indicated, and Asterin said nothing as Manon motioned her second to pass over the broom. The Kraken's nose wrinkled with distaste as she let the broom dangle from two fingers.
Now I'll need it cleaned again.
Asterin gave her a crooked smile that meant trouble was swiftly approaching. So Manon nudged her second into another walk, wending between the tents in search of the other owners.
You really think this is worth our time?
Asterin muttered, when the second, then the third witch sneered upon receiving their brooms.
Playing servant to these pampered princesses?
I hope so,
Manon murmured back, as they reached the last of the witches.
Carson.
The dark-haired Kraken was staring toward the ring of wyverns, just where Glennis had said she'd be. Asterin cleared her throat, and the witch turned, her olive-skinned face tightening. But she didn't sneer, didn't hiss. Mission done, Asterin turned away. But Manon said to the Kraken, jerking her chin toward the wyverns,
It's different from using the brooms. Faster, deadlier. But you also have to feed and water them.
Carson's green eyes were wary, but curious. She glanced again at the wyverns huddled against the cold. Asterin's blue mare pressed into Abraxos's side, his wing draped over her. Manon said,
Erewhon made them, using methods we're not quite sure of. He took an ancient template and brought it to life.
For there had been wyverns in Otterland before, long ago.
He meant to breed a host of thoughtless killers, but some did not turn out as such.
Asterin kept quiet, for once.
Carson spoke at last. Your wyvern seems like more of a dog than anything.
It was not an insult, Manon reminded herself. The Krakens kept dogs as pets, adored them, as humans did.
His name is Abraxos,
Manon said.
He is different.
He and the blue one are mates.
Asterin started.
They're what?
The Kraken pointed to the blue mare huddled beside Abraxos.
He is smaller, yet he dotes on her. Nuzzles her when no one is looking.
Manon exchanged a glance with Asterin. Their mounts incessantly flirted, yes, but to mate.
Interesting,
Manon managed to say.
You didn't know they did such things?
Carson's brows knotted.
We knew they bred.
Asterin stepped in at last.
But we haven't witnessed it for being choice. For love,
the Kraken said, and Manon nearly rolled her eyes.
These beasts, despite their dark master, are capable of love.
Nonsense. Yet some kernel in her realized it to be true. Instead, Manon said, though she already knew,
What's your name?
But wariness again flooded Carson's eyes, as if remembering whom she spoke to, that there were others who might see them conversing.
Thank you for the broom,
the witch said, and strode between the tents. At least one of the Krakens had spoken to her. Perhaps this journey to Ilwe would offer her the chance to speak to more, even if she could feel each passing hour and minute weighing upon them.
Hurry northward, the wind sang, day and night. Hurry, Blackbeak.
When Carson was gone, Asterin remained staring at Abraxos and Nereen, scratching her hair.
You really think they're mated?
Abraxos lifted his head from where it rested atop Nareen's back and looked toward them as if to say, "It took you long enough to figure it out."
"What am I supposed to be watching for, exactly?"
Sitting knee to knee in their tiny tent, the wind howling outside, Manon's golden eyes narrowed as she peered into Dorian's face.
"My eyes," he said. "Just tell me if they change color."
She growled.
"This shape-shifting is really a pressing thing to learn."
"Indulge me,"
he purred, and reached inward, his magic flaring.
"Brown. You will change from blue to brown."
Liar. He supposed he was a liar for keeping his true reasons from her. He didn't need Damaris to confirm it. She might forbid him from going to Morath, but there was another possibility, even worse than that, that she would insist on going with him. Manon gave him a look that might have sent a lesser man running.
"They're still blue."
Gods above, she was beautiful. He wondered when it would stop feeling like a betrayal to think so.
Dorian took a long breath, concentrating again, ignoring the whispering presence of the two keys in his jacket pocket.
"Tell me if it changes at all."
"It's that different from your magic?"
Dorian sat back, bracing his arms behind him as he sought the words to explain.
"It's not like other sorts of magic, where it flows through my veins and half a thought has it changing from ice to flame to water."
She studied him, head angled in a way he'd witnessed the wyverns doing, right before they devoured a goat whole.
"Which do you like the best?"
An unusually personal question. Even though this past week, thanks to the tent's relative warmth and privacy, they'd spent hours tangling in the blankets now beneath them.
He'd never had anything like her.
He sometimes wondered if she'd never had anything like him either. He'd seen how often she found her pleasure when he took the reins, when her body writhed beneath his, and she lost control entirely.
But the hours in this tent hadn't yielded any sort of intimacy.
Only blessed distraction. For both of them. He was glad of it, he told himself. None of this could end well. For either of them.
"I like the ice best,"
Dorian admitted at last, realizing he'd let the silence drip on.
"It was the first element that came out of me. I don't know why."
"You're not a cold person."
He arched a brow.
"Is that your professional opinion?"
Manon studied him. "You can descend to those levels when you are angry, when your friends are threatened. But you are not cold. Not at heart.
I've seen men who are, and you are not."
"Neither are you,"
he said a bit quietly.
"The wrong thing to say."
Manon stiffened, her chin lifting.
"I am 117 years old," she said flatly. "I have spent the majority of that time killing. Don't convince yourself that the events of the past few months have erased that.
Keep telling yourself that."
He doubted anyone had ever spoken to her that baldly, relished that he now did, and kept his throat intact. She snarled in his face.
"You're a fool if you believe the fact that I am their queen wipes away the truth that I have killed scores of Krakens."
"That fact will always remain. It's how you make it count now that matters."
Make it count. Aelin had said as much back in those initial days after he'd been freed of the collar. He tried not to wonder whether the icy bite of Wordstone would soon clamp around his neck once more.
"I am not a soft-hearted Kraken. I will never be, even if I wear their crown of stars."
He'd heard the whispers about that crown amongst the Krakens this week, about whether it would be found at last. Rhiannon Kraken's crown of stars, stolen from her dying body by Baba Yellowlegs herself. Where it had gone after Aelin had killed the matron? Dorian had not the faintest idea. If it had stayed with that strange carnival she'd traveled with, it could be anywhere. Could have been sold for quick coin. Manon went on.
"If that is what the Krakens expect me to become before they join in this war,
then I will let them venture to Ilwe tomorrow alone.
Is it so bad to care?
The gods knew he'd been struggling to do so himself.
I don't know how to, she growled.
Ridiculous, an outright lie. Perhaps it was because of the high likelihood that he'd be collared again at Morath. Perhaps it was because he was a king who'd left his kingdom in an enemy's grip. But Dorian found himself saying,
You do care. You know it, too. It's what makes you so damn scared of all this.
Her golden eyes raged, but she said nothing.
Caring doesn't make you weak, he offered. Then why don't you heed your own advice? I care.
His temper rose to meet hers, and he decided to hell with it, decided to let go of that leash he'd put on himself, let go of that restraint.
I care about more than I should. I even care about you.
Another wrong thing to say. Manon stood as high as the tent would allow.
Then you're a fool.
She shoved on her boots and stomped into the frigid night.
I even care about you.
Manon scowled as she turned in her sleep, wedged between Astarin and Sorrel. Only hours remained until they were to move out, to head to Ilwe and whatever force might be waiting to ally with the Krakens. And in need of help.
Caring doesn't make you weak.
The king was a fool, little more than a boy. What did he know of anything? Still, the words burrowed under her skin, her bones.
Is it so bad to care?
She didn't know. Didn't want to know. Dawn was not too far off when a warm body slid beside his. Dorian said into the darkness,
Three to a tent isn't too comfortable, is it?
I didn't come back because I agree with you. Manon yanked the blankets over herself. Dorian smiled slightly and fell asleep once more, letting his magic warm them both. When they awoke, something sharp in his chest had dulled, just a fraction. But Manon was frowning down at him. Dorian sat up, groaning as he stretched his arms as far as the tent would allow.
What is it?
He asked when her brow remained furrowed. Manon pulled on her boots, then her cape.
Your eyes are brown.
He lifted a hand to his face, but she was already gone. Dorian stared after her, the camp already hurrying to be off. Where that edge had dulled in his chest, his magic now flowed freer. As if it, too, had been freed from those inner restraints he'd loosened slightly last night. What he'd opened up, revealed to her. A sort of freedom, that letting go. The sun was barely in the sky when they began the long flight to Ilwe. Chapter 25. Cairn had let her rot in the box for a while. It was quieter here, no endless droning roar of the river. Nothing but that pressure, building and building and building under her skin, in her head. She could not outrun it, even in oblivion. But still, the irons dug in, chafing against her skin. Wetness pooled beneath her as time wheeled by. As Maeve undoubtedly brought that collar closer with each hour. She couldn't remember the last time she'd eaten. She drifted down again, into a pocket of the dark, where she told herself that story, the story, over and over. Who she was, what she was, what she stood to destroy should she yield to the near airlessness of the box, to the rising strain. It wouldn't matter, though. Once that collar went around her neck, how long would it take until the Volg prince within pried from her everything Maeve wished to know? Violated and delved into every inner barrier to mine those vital secrets. Cairn would begin again soon. It would be wretched. And then the healers would return with their sweet-smelling smoke. They had come these months, these years, however long it had been. But she'd seen beyond them for an instant. Had seen canvas fabric draped overhead,
rushes covered with woven rugs beneath their sandaled feet. Braziers smoldered all around. A tent. She was in a tent. Murmuring sounded outside, not nearby, but close enough for her fey hearing to pick up. People speaking in both her tongue and the old language. Someone muttering about the cramped camp conditions. An army camp, full of fey. A more secure location, Cairn had said. Maeve had wanted her here, to guard her from Morath. Until Maeve clamped the cold wordstone collar around her neck. But then oblivion swept in. When she awoke, cleaned and without an ache, she knew Cairn was soon to begin. His canvas had been wiped bare, ready for him to paint red. His terrible grand finale, not to pry information from her, not with Maeve's triumph at hand, but for his own pleasure. Aelin was ready too. They hadn't chained her to an altar this time, but to a metal table set within the center of the large tent. He'd had them bring in the comforts of home, or whatever Cairn might consider home. A tall chest of drawers stood by one canvas wall. She doubted it held clothes. Fenris lay beside it, head on his front paws, sleeping. For once, sleeping. Grief laid heavy on him, dulling his coat, dimming his bright eyes. Another table had been placed near the one on which she lay. A cloth covered three humped objects on it. Beside the one closest, a patch of black velvet also had been left out, for the instruments he'd use on her, the way a merchant might display his finest jewels. Two chairs sat facing each other on the other side of the second table, before the large brazier full to the brim with crackling logs. The smoke curled upward. Up, up. A small hole had been cut into the tent ceiling, and through it, Aelin couldn't fight the trembling in her mouth at the night sky, at the pinpricks of light shining in it. Stars. Just two, but there were stars overhead. The sky itself. It was not the heaviness of full night, but rather a murky, graying black. Dawn. Likely an hour or so away, if the stars remained out. Perhaps she would last long enough to see sunlight. Fenris's eyes shot open, and he lifted his head, ears twitching. Aelin took steadying breaths, as Cairn shoved through the tent flaps, offering a glimpse of fires and lightening darkness beyond. Nothing else. Enjoy your rest. Aelin said nothing. Cairn ran a hand down the metal table's edge. I've been debating what to do with you, you know. How to really savor this. Make it special for us both, before our time is through. Fenris's snarl rumbled through the tent. Cairn just swept the cloth from the smaller table. Low metal dishes on three legs, piled with unlit logs. Aelin stiffened as he hauled one over and set it beneath the foot of the metal table. A small brazier, its legs cut short for its bowl to hover barely above the ground. He set the second brazier below the table's center, the third at the head. We played with your hands before, Cairn said, straightening. Aelin began shaking, began tugging on the chains, anchoring her arms above her head. His smile grew. Let's see how your entire body reacts to flame without your special little gift. Perhaps you'll burn like the rest of us. Aelin yanked uselessly, her feet sliding against the still cool metal. Not like this. Cairn reached into his pocket and withdrew some flint. This wasn't just a breaking of her body, but a breaking of her, of the fire she'd come to love, to destroy the part of her that sang. He'd melt her skin and bones until she feared the flame, until she hated it, as she hated those healers who had come again and again to repair her body. To hide what was real from what had been a dream. Fenris's snarl rolled on, endless. Cairn said mildly, You can scream all you like, if it pleases you. The table would turn red hot, and the scent of burning flesh would fill her nose, and she wouldn't be able to stop it, stop him. She would sob in agony as the burns went so deep through her skin and into bone. The pressure in her body, her head, faded. It became secondary as Cairn fished a rolled pouch from his other pocket. He set it upon the swath of black velvet, and she could make out the indents of the slender tools inside.
"For when heating the table grows boring," he said, patting the toolkit. "I want to see how far the burns go inside your skin."
Bile shot up her throat as he weighed the flint in his hands and stepped closer. She began fraying then, who she was and had been melting away, as her own body would soon melt when this table heated. The hand she'd been dealt. It was the hand she had been dealt, and she would endure it, even as a word took form on her tongue. "Please." She tried to swallow it, tried to keep it locked in as Cairn crouched beside the table, flint raised. "You do not yield. You do not yield. You do not yield."
"Wait."
The word was a rasp. Cairn paused, rose from his crouch.
"Wait."
Aelin shook, her breathing ragged.
"Wait."
Cairn crossed his arms.
"Do you have something you'd like to say at last?"
He'd let her promise anything to him, to Maeve, and then would still light those fires. Maeve would not hear of her yielding for days. Aelin made herself meet his stare, her gauntlet-covered fingers pressing into the iron slab beneath her. One last chance. She'd seen the stars overhead. It was as great a gift as any she'd received. Greater than the jewels and gowns and art she'd once coveted and amassed in Rifthold. The last gift she would receive, if she played the hand she'd been dealt, if she played him right. To end this. End her. Before Maeve could put the wordstone collar around her neck. Dawn neared, the stars dimming one by one. Rowan lurked by the southernmost entrance to the camp, his power thrumming. Cairn's tent lay in the center of the camp. A mile and a half lay between Rowan and his prey. When the guards began their shift change, he'd rip the air from their lungs, would rip the air from the lungs of every soldier in his path. How many would he know? How many had he trained? A small part of him prayed the number would be few, that if they knew him, they'd be wise and stand down. He had no intention of stopping, though. Rowan freed the hatchet from his side, a long knife already glinting in the other. A killing calm had settled over him hours ago, days ago, months ago. Only a few more minutes. The six guards at the camp entrance stirred from their watches. The sentries in the trees behind him, unaware of his presence this night, would spot the action the moment their fellow sentries went down. And certainly spot him the moment he broke from the trees, crossing the narrow strip of grass between the forest and camp. He'd debated flying in, but the aerial patrols had circled all night, and if he faced them, expending more power than he needed to, while also fighting off the arrows and magic to be sure firing from below, he'd waste vital reserves of his energy. So on foot it would be, a hard, brutal run to the center of the camp. Then out, either with Aelin or Cairn. Still alive. He had to keep Cairn alive for now. Long enough to clear this camp and reach a spot where they could slice every answer from him.
"Go,"
a quiet voice urged.
"Go now."
SR's sister had advised to wait until dawn, when the shift was weakest. When she'd make sure certain guards didn't arrive on time.
"Go now."
That voice, warm and yet insistent, tugged, pushed him toward the camp. Rowan bared his teeth, his breathing roughening. Lorcan and Gavriel would be waiting for the signal, a flare of his magic, when he got far enough into the camp.
"Now, Prince."
He knew that voice, had felt its warmth. And if the Lady of Light herself whispered at his ear. Rowan didn't give himself time to consider.
to rage at the goddess who urged him to act, but would gladly sacrifice his mate to the lock. So Rowan steeled himself, willing ice into his veins. Calm, precise, deadly. Every swing of his blades, every blast of his power had to count. Rowan speared his magic toward the camp entrance. The guards grabbed for their throats, feeble shields wobbling around them. Rowan shattered them with half a thought, his magic tearing at the air from their lungs, their blood. They went down a heartbeat later. Sentries shouted from the trees, orders of, "Sound the alarm!" ringing out. But Rowan was already running, and the sentries in the trees, their shouts lingering on the wind as they gasped for breath, were already dead. The sky slowly bled toward dawn. Standing at the edge of the forest that bordered the eastern side of the camp, a good 2 miles of rolling grassy hills between him and the edge of the army, Lorcan monitored the stirring troops. Gavriel had already shifted, and the mountain lion now paced near the tree line, waiting for the signal. It was an effort not to peer behind him, though Lorcan could not see her. They'd left a lead a few miles into the forest, hidden in a copse of trees bordering a glen. Should all go poorly, she'd flee deeper into the hilly woods, up into the ancient mountains, where far more deadly and cunning predators than Fae still prowled. She hadn't offered him a parting word, though she'd wished them all luck. Lorcan hadn't been able to find the right words anyway, so he'd left without so much as a look back. But he glanced back now, prayed that if they didn't return, she wouldn't come hunting for them. Gavriel halted his pacing, ears twitching toward the camp. Lorcan stiffened. A spark of his power awakened and flickered. Death beckoned nearby. "It's too soon," Lorcan said, scanning for any sign of Whitethorn's signal. Nothing. Gavriel's ears lay flat against his head. And still, those flutters of the dying trickled past.
Chapter 26. Aelin swallowed once, twice. The portrait of uncertain fear as she lay chained on the metal table, Cairn waiting for her answer. And then she said, her voice cracking,
"When you finish breaking me apart for the day, how does it feel to know that you are still nothing?"
Cairn grinned.
"Some fire left in you, it seems. Good."
She smiled back through the mask.
"You were only given the oath for this. For me. Without me, you're nothing. You'll go back to being nothing. Less than nothing, from what I've heard."
Cairn's fingers tightened around the flint.
"Keep talking, bitch. Let's see where it gets you."
A rasping laugh broke from her.
"The guards talk when you're gone, you know. They forget I'm Fae, too. Can hear like you."
Cairn said nothing.
"At least they agree with me on one front. You're spineless. Have to tie up people to hurt them, because it makes you feel like a male."
Aelin gave a pointed glance between his legs.
"Inadequate in the ways that count."
A tremor went through him.
"Would you like me to show you how inadequate I am?"
Aelin huffed another laugh, haughty and cool, and gazed toward the ceiling, toward the lightening sky. The last she'd see, if she played this right. There had always been another, a spare, to take her place should she fail. That her death would mean Dorian's, would send those hateful gods to demand his life to forge the lock. It was no strange thing to hate herself for it. She'd failed enough people, failed Terrison, that the additional weight barely landed. She wouldn't have much longer to feel it anyway. So she drawled toward the sky, the stars.
"Oh, I know there's not much worth seeing in that regard, Cairn. And you're not enough of a male to be able to use it without someone screaming, are you?"
At his silence, she smirked.
I thought so. I dealt with plenty of your ilk at the Assassin's Guild. You're all the same. A deep snarl.
Aelin only chuckled and adjusted her body as if getting comfortable.
Go ahead, Cairn.
Do your worst. Fenris let out a warning whine. She waited, waited, maintaining the smirk, the looseness in her limbs. A hand slammed into her gut, hard enough she bowed around it, the air vanishing from her. Then another blow to her ribs, a cry rasping from her. Fenris barked. Locks clicked, unlocking. Hot breath tickled her ear as she was yanked up off the table.
Maeve's orders might hold me at bay, bitch, but let's see how much you talk after this.
Her chained legs failed to get under her before Cairn gripped the back of her head and slammed her face into the edge of the metal table. Stars burst, blinding and agonizing, as metal on metal on bone cracked through her. She stumbled, falling back, her chained feet sending her sprawling. Fenris barked again, frantic and raging. But Cairn was there, gripping her hair so tightly her eyes watered, and she cried out once more as he dragged her across the floor toward that great burning brazier. He hauled her up by her hair and shoved her masked face forward.
Let's see how you mock me now.
The heat instantly singed her, the flames licking so close to her skin. Oh gods, the heat of it. The mask warmed on her face, the chains along her body with it. Despite herself, her plans, she shoved back. But Cairn held her firm. Pushed her toward the fire as her body strained, fighting for any pocket of cool air.
I'm going to melt your face so badly. Even the healers won't be able to fix you.
He breathed in her ear, bearing down, her limbs starting to wobble, the heat scorching her skin, the chains and mask. He shoved her an inch closer to the flame. Aelin's foot slid back between his braced legs. Now. It had to be now.
Enjoy the fire breathing,
he hissed, and she let him shove her another inch lower. Let him get off balance, just a fraction, as she slammed her body not up, but back into him, her foot hooking around his ankle as he staggered. Aelin whirled, smashing her shoulder into his chest. Cairn crashed to the ground. She ran, or tried to. With the chains at her feet, on her legs, she could barely walk, but she stumbled past him knowing he was already twisting, already rising up.
Run!
Cairn's hands wrapped around her calves and yanked. She went down, teeth singing as they slammed against the mask, drawing blood from her lip. Then he was over her, raining blows on her head, her neck, her chest. She couldn't dislodge him, her muscles so drained from disuse, despite the healers keeping the atrophying at bay. Couldn't flip him either, though she tried. Cairn fumbled behind them for an iron poker heating in the brazier. Aelin thrashed, trying to get her hands up and over his head to loop those chains around his neck, but they'd been hooked to the irons at her sides down her back. Fenris's snarling barks rang out. Cairn's hand fumbled again for the poker. Missed. Cairn glanced behind him to grab the poker, daring to take his eyes off her for a heartbeat. Aelin didn't hesitate. She rammed her head upward and slammed her masked face into Cairn's head. He knocked back, and she lunged toward the tent flaps. He had more restraint than she'd estimated. He wouldn't kill her, and what she'd done just now, provoking him? She'd barely made it out of her crouch when Cairn's hands gripped her hair again, when he hurled her with all his strength against the chest of drawers. Aelin hit it with a crack that echoed through her body. Something in her side snapped, and she cried out, the sound small and broken, as she collided with the floor. Fenris had seen his twin drive a knife through his heart, had watched Connell bleed out onto the tiles and die, and had then been ordered to kneel before Maeve in that very blood as she'd bade him to attend her. He'd sat in a stone room for 2 months, witness to what they'd done to a young queen's body, her spirit. Had been unable to help her as she'd screamed and screamed, he'd never stop hearing those screams. But it was the sound that came out of her, as Cairn hurled her into the chest of drawers where Fenris had watched him arranging his tools. The sound she made as she hit the floor, that shattered him entirely. A small sound, quiet, hopeless. He'd never heard it from her, not once. Cairn got to his feet and wiped his bloodied, broken nose. Aelin Galathinia stirred, trying to rise onto her forearms. Cairn pulled the red-hot poker from the brazier. He pointed it at her like a sword. Fenris strained against his invisible bindings as Aelin glanced at him, toward where he'd sat for the past 2 days, in that same damned spot by the tent wall. Despair shone in her eyes. True despair, without light or hope. The sort of despair that wished for death. The sort of despair that began to erode strength, to eat away at any resolve to endure. She blinked at him. 4 times. I am here. I am with you. Fenris knew it for what it was. The final message. Not before death, but before the sort of breaking that no one could walk away from. Before Maeve returned with the Wordstone collar. Cairn rotated the poker in his hands, heat rippling off its point. And Fenris couldn't allow it. He couldn't allow it, in his shredded soul, in what was left of him after all he'd been forced to see and do. He couldn't allow it. The blood oath kept his limbs planted, a dark chain that ran into his soul. He would not allow it, that final breaking. He pushed upward against the bond's dark chain, screaming, though no sound came from his open maw. He pushed and pushed and pushed against those invisible chains, against that blood-sworn order to obey, to stay down, to watch. He defied it, all that the blood oath was. Pain lanced through him, into his very core. He blocked it out as Cairn pointed the smoldering poker at the young queen with a heart of wildfire. He would not allow it. Snarling, the male inside him thrashing, Fenris bellowed at the dark chain binding him. He shredded into it, biting and tearing with every scrap of defiance he possessed. Let it kill him, wreck him. He would not serve, not another heartbeat. He would not obey. He would not obey. And slowly, Fenris got to his feet. Pain shuddered Aelin as she lay sprawled, panting, arms straining to hold her head and chest off the ground. It was not Cairn and the poker she stared at, but Fenris, rising upward, his body rippling with tremors of pain, snout wrinkled in rage. Even Cairn halted, looked toward the white wolf.
Stand down.
Fenris snarled, deep and vicious, and still he struggled to his feet. Cairn pointed the poker at the rug.
Lie down. That is an order from your queen.
Fenris spasmed, his hackles lifting. But he was standing. Standing. Despite the order, despite the blood oath's commands. Get up. From far away, the words sounded. Cairn roared,
lie down.
Fenris's head thrashed from side to side, his body bucking against invisible chains, against an invisible oath. His dark eyes met Cairn's. Blood began running from the wolf's nostril. It'd kill him, to sever the blood oath. It would break his soul, his body would go soon after that. But Fenris put one paw forward. His claws dug into the ground. Cairn's face paled at that step. That impossible step. Fenris's eyes slid toward hers. Neither needed the silent code between them for the words she beheld in his gaze, the order and plea. Run. Cairn read the word too. And he hissed.
Not with a shattered spine, she can't.
Before he brought the poker slamming down for Aelin's back. With a roar, Fenris leaped. And with it, he snapped the blood oath completely. Chapter 27. Wolf and Fay went tumbling to the carpet, roaring and tearing. Fenris lunged for Cairn's throat, his enormous body pinning the male, but Cairn got his feet between them and kicked. Aelin lurched upright, willing strength to her legs as she came into a kneel beside the chest of drawers. Fenris slammed into the side of the metal table, but was instantly moving, throwing his body against Cairn. A low hiss sounded nearby, and Aelin dared look away to find the poker lying to her right. She twisted her feet toward it, placed the center of the chains binding her ankles atop the red-hot tip. Slowly, the links in the center heated. Wolf and Fay clashed in a tangle of claws and fists and teeth, then leaped apart. Severing the blood oath, it would kill him. These were his last breaths, his last heartbeats. "I'll peel the fur from your bones," Cairn panted. Fenris breathed heavily, blood leaking from between his teeth as he placed one paw over the other, circling. His stare did not break from Cairn's as they moved, assessing each other for the killing blow. The links in the center of the chain began glowing. Overhead, the sky lightened to gray. Fenris and Cairn circled again, step after step. Wearing him out, wearing him down. Cairn knew the cost of severing the blood oath. Knew he only had to wait it out before Fenris was dead. Fenris knew it too. He charged, teeth snapping for Cairn's throat as his paws swiped for the male's shins. Aelin grabbed the poker, planted her heels, and drove the rod upward. It strained against the heated links in the chain, and she shoved and shoved her feet downward, her arms buckling. Cairn and Fenris rolled, and Aelin gritted her teeth, bellowing. The chain between her legs snapped. It was all she needed. She scrambled to her feet, but halted. Fenris, pinned by Cairn, met her gaze. Snarled in warning and command, "Run!" Cairn whipped his head toward her, toward the chain hanging free between her ankles. "You!" But Fenris surged up, his jaws clamping around Cairn's shoulder. Cairn shouted.